My name is Marshall Graver, and I am a member of the Board of Governors of the Middle East Forum. Thanks for coming today to our latest Middle East Forum briefing. I'm pleased to introduce our speaker for today, Stephen Schwartz. And before I do, just a few announcements. We ask that you please turn off your cell phones and beepers and hold questions and comments until the end of the program when Daniel will conduct a question and answer session. About our speaker, Mr. Schwartz is a senior policy analyst at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies in Washington, D.C. An author and a journalist, Mr. Schwartz has reported on religious affairs in the Balkans and other areas around the world for many years. He was on the staff of the San Francisco Chronicle, worked as the Washington chief of the Forward, and lives in Washington, D.C. Today's event features an informative look at Saudi Arabia's links to al-Qaeda. In his best-selling book, The Two Faces of Islam, Mr. Schwartz explains Islam's complex history and describes the philosophical and religious differences that distinguish traditional beliefs from the radical sects that have sprung up over the past 1,500 years. He focuses on Wahhabism, the puritanical sect to which Osama bin Laden belongs, and sets the current upheavals within a historical and religious context. Mr. Schwartz demonstrates that Osama bin Laden and his followers are not really fighting a war against America. Rather, they are engaged in a revolution within Islam itself. Mr. Schwartz exposes the collusion of the Saudi Arabian government in the spread of radical Islam, which makes them at best reluctant allies of the West, and shows that the majority of Muslims have little sympathy for the Wahhabis, and that many openly denounce their motivations and goals. It's my pleasure to introduce Mr. Stephen Schwartz.
Thank you. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I'm extremely pleased to be here today. I'm going to discuss my book, The Two Faces of Islam, The House of Saud from Tradition to Terror, the first extensive study published in the West of the phenomenon of Wahhabism, its involvement with the royal authorities of Saudi Arabia, and the entanglement of the sect and the kingdom with the global organization and financing of Islamic extremism and terrorism. I'll get right to the point. Al-Qaeda represents Wahhabism in its purest form. Wahhabism, the official sect in Saudi Arabia, is a fundamentalist, violent movement that rejects all existing Islam, non-Wahhabi Islam, especially Islamic spirituality, as well as seeking ultimately the destruction of Shia Islam, Judaism, Christianity, Hinduism, Sikhism. I'd add that it's very important also to understand that Wahhabism rejects civility between these faiths and rejects the concept of mixed societies. Wahhabism is not an old Islamic tradition. And contrary to Western beliefs, the House of Saud does not enjoy a major historic claim to rulership over Arabia. Wahhabism emerged in the 18th century in Central Arabia, only 250 years ago. The founder of the movement, an obscure figure named Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab, formed an alliance with a clan of desert bandits, the House of Saud. The area where these events transpired is located on the main route or pilgrims going to Mecca from the east and the Muslim Hajj from Kuwait, or via Kuwait, especially Indian pilgrims, who in the 18th century were a rich source of plunder for the Al-Saud. Wahhabism was observed and commented upon by Western journalists and authors in its own time. I mention this because it's very common now to hear the opponents of my perspective suggesting somehow this is all invented, some Zionist disinformation or something. We have a pretty substantial body of reportage and commentary from the early 19th century, because when the Wahhabis seized Mecca and Medina in the first decade of the 19th century, it was a world historical event. It was widely commented on in Europe and even in America. For example, a 19th century British author, Thomas Hope, wrote a novel titled Anastasius that made a tremendous impression in the 1830s. People believed that it was actually written by Lord Byron, which it wasn't, but Hope, who had traveled widely in the Islamic world, painted the Wahhabi sect in colors strikingly familiar to a modern reader as extremist Puritans bent on total control over the world's Muslims, beginning with the destruction of the Ottoman Empire, as Arab ultranationalists, to use a contemporary term, and as terrorists. In one of his most extraordinary passages for a modern reader, Hope described Wahhabi agents scoping out targeted buildings in Baghdad in the 1790s. an activity chillingly reminiscent of what we know about how Al-Qaeda works. The House of Ibn Abd al-Wahhab and the House of Saud created a theological and political alliance in which the Wahhabis direct religious affairs and the Saudis exercise political control. This alliance seized control of the main holy sites of Islam, Mecca and Medina, twice, murdering thousands of people in the process. In 1924, with the complicity of Britain, the Wahhabis seized Mecca for the second and last time. After that came the oil and the oil money, and with what seemed to be limitless resources, the Wahhabi-Saudi alliance began in the late 1970s a serious attempt to take over world Islam. The result was a series of conflicts in Afghanistan and elsewhere. Now, when I say a series of conflicts in Afghanistan, I don't mean that the Wahhabis started this war with the Russians, obviously. They intervened in what was, in fact, a righteous and major struggle in which the United States correctly intervened to defend Afghanistan against the Russians. But the Saudis intervened to turn it in their own direction. The result was, in Afghanistan, the rise of the Taliban. This process was repeated with varying success, not much success really, but many substantial efforts elsewhere in the Islamic world, all of it culminating in the emergence of Al-Qaeda and finally the horrific events of September 11th. Today, as it did before September 11th, the Wahhabi religious bureaucracy inside Saudi Arabia continues to foster Islamic extremism and the terrorism that goes with it. When bombs go off in Israel, in Indonesia, in Kenya, and elsewhere, the main source of money remains Saudi Arabia. Those who argue that Islamist extremism is a product of U.S. support for corrupt regimes have a point, and we can discuss that. But they ignore that the main source of ideology, incitement, and funds for Islamist terror today remains Saudi Arabia, and for some period of time has been Saudi Arabia. The Saudi elite, a section of it, tried to confuse Western opinion by proclaiming that they too are targets of Osama bin Laden. But their real intent is to mask their own complicity in his financing and organization. Let me mention something here. Saudi Arabia is a police state. Saudi Arabia is a wealthy state with considerable resources. If the Saudis had wanted to get rid of Osama bin Laden, it would have been done a long time ago, and nobody in the West would have ever even had to hear about it. In reality, Islamist terrorism is only partially a protest movement by certain Saudi subjects aggrieved at the monarchy's alliance with the West. It is, in much greater part, a phenomenon directly impelled by the Saudi clerics. Above all, Al-Qaeda would not exist without Saudi membership and Saudi money. We must stop telling ourselves and others that Saudi Arabia represents some ineffably mysterious, ancient, and traditional society that we must approach reluctantly with extreme caution and at arm's length, especially when discussing the need for political change there. We must stop telling ourselves and others that the main danger of political change in the kingdom would involve a shift to a more extreme Islamist regime. There is no mystery to Saudi Arabia. It represents the worst example in present times of a corrupt and reactionary absolute monarchy whose rulers have great difficulty perceiving the depth of the crisis that faces them, as well as the way out of the crisis. The Saudi royal family can no longer rule in the old way, and their subjects, with a growing youthful majority, increasingly refuse to live in the old way. There is nothing novel about this. The same problem characterized the regime of the Iranian Shah. Nor does it represent anything ancient or traditional. To emphasize, Wahhabi Islam is not traditional Islam. It is an extremely destructive, nihilistic, and radical form of Islam. Wahhabism preaches an ultra-puritanical way of life in which I might mention that you're not allowed to smile at non-Wahhabi Muslims. You're not allowed to sing or listen to music as we understand it. You're not allowed to keep gardens or pick flowers. I can listen. If I start listening to things that the Wahhabis forbid, it will shock you that you're not allowed to praise the personality of the Prophet Muhammad. You're not allowed to visit graves, the graves of the companions of the Prophet, most of which have been dug up and destroyed. While they preach this ultra-puritanical way of life, the Saudi elite swims in whiskey and dizzies itself with pornography. Wahhabism claims to be the purest form of Islam, while the Saudi monarchy depends on Christian bayonets for its protection. Let me mention the 1989 incident when the Grand Mosque was seized in Mecca by some ultra-Wahhabis. What? 79. Oh, 79, sorry. Who was it that went in and cleaned out the Grand Mosque? French paratroops who murdered Muslims on the on the territory of Grand Mosque. These mixed signals, or more bluntly, these forms of hypocrisy have a deranged effect on Saudi, a deranging effect on Saudi society, but they are also the essential source of Islamist extremism and terrorism. To close the gap between Wahhabi blandishments and Saudi reality, and in a desperate attempt to recover their credibility, particularly in the 20 years since the emergence of Khomeini in Iran, the reactionary faction of the Saudi monarchy has financed terrorism and infiltration throughout the Islamic world. In Central Asia, in Pakistan, in the Balkans, in Algeria, in Egypt, in Israel, in Afghanistan, in the Caucasus, in the Philippines, and in Indonesia. And finally, in its ultimate form, in Al-Qaeda. We hear a lot about Islamist terrorism, Islamist extremism being a product of the humiliation of Islamic countries by the West. Saudi Arabia has never been subjugated by the West and has never been humiliated by the West. Rather, its rulers have been pampered, coddled, and bribed by the West. Its dependence on military support from the West, the pretext for Al-Qaeda terrorism against Americans, is hardly new. Over its 2.5 centuries of existence, Wahhabism has always depended on its alliances with Christian powers, Britain, the U.S., and France, to protect its rule in the Arabian Peninsula. At the same time, to its own population, it preaches a toxic mix of ferocious separatism, exclusionism, and murderous violence directed against non-Wahhabi Muslims and non-Muslims. The former aspect has led gullible policy experts in the West to view the Sudairi faction, Wahhabi faction around King Fahd and Princes Sultan and Nayef as friends of the U.S., and to stigmatize all opponents of the regime as extremists. In contrast both with Wahhabi separatism and Western stereotypes about dissent in the kingdom, traditionalists under Saudi rule call for an advent of general religious liberty. This is not a matter. One of the problems I have in Washington is people are constantly talking about forcing Saudi to accept the right of people to convert to Christianity. We're not talking about the right of people to convert to Christianity. We are talking about the right of thousands of indigenous Arab Christians who have lived underground in Saudi since 1924 to come out in the open and reopen their churches, for example, in the city of Jeddah, where there are two churches. General call for religious liberty to accommodate Arab Christians now underground, as well as the many thousands of Christian, Hindu, and Buddhist guest workers in the kingdom, as well as foreign Christian and Jewish visitors. Issues involving activist Christian proselytism would doubtless remain sensitive, but traditionalists see no justification for preventing Christians from worshiping. Saudis falsely claim that exclusion of non-Muslim religious rituals in the Arabian Peninsula reflects Islamic tradition. But Qatar, the only other Wahhabi state, has authorized the erection of new Christian churches, of which there are many in Bahrain, where there is a Jewish community, and a Hindu community. There is a Hindu temple in Oman. By the way, I'm going to add for this group, one of the most interesting stories I've been following up is the existence of an underground community of Jews in the southern territory of the kingdom, an area that was annexed from Yemen, and there is a community of Yemeni Jews who never left the southern area of the kingdom, who are essentially living underground there. I mean, underground in the sense of not openly being Jews. Make no mistake, even non-extremist Saudi subjects experience hopelessness and frustration, but their resentment does not flow from abject poverty or living in refugee camps. Saudi Arabia faces great discontent among its population. This discontent does not reflect a desire, except among the clerical bureaucracy and the Wahhabi faction of the royal family, for Wahhabism to be reinforced and maintained. The vast majority of Saudi subjects are restive because of three factors. First, Shia Muslims in the eastern province and southern region are tired of the violent discrimination they have suffered at the hands of the Wahhabi-Saudi alliance. These Shias are not prone to Islamist extremism. Second, two generations of Saudi subjects are educated and entrepreneurial. They know how the real world works. They have access to satellite television and the internet. They are tired of their educated and entrepreneurial ambitions being blocked by the corrupt and sclerotic system. They want to live in a modern society, such as would most resemble Malaysia, a constitutional and parliamentary Islamic monarchy. Finally, and most significantly, non-Wahhabi Islamic scholars, especially in Hejaz, the region of Mecca and Medina, seek the restoration of the theological Islamic pluralism that was abolished by the Wahhabis when they took over in 1924. In recent discussions with dissident Saudis, I have learned that thousands of young people are now turning to the peaceful and spiritual form of Islam known as Sufism as an expression of opposition to the Wahhabi dictatorship in the country. A necessary and inevitable transformation of Saudi Arabia need not turn into a bloody collapse. There is sufficient possibility for a managed transition to a Malaysian model. I call this the Juan Carlos Windsor Malaysia solution. Like Juan Carlos in Spain, if a member of the royal family were to come forward and to announce that the links between the monarchy and the Wahhabi ideology were going to be severed, that the monarchy would no longer support the Wahhabi clerics, that the Wahhabi sect would have to be one among many sects that would exist in a restored, pluralistic Islamic situation, this would be a tremendous step forward. I would not object if, like the Windsors in Britain, the Saudi royal family were to retain their wealth and even their status as heads of state, but without ruling the country. Above all, the Malaysian model could emerge as the best alternative for Arabia. I also believe it is absurd to think that a successor political regime would necessarily reflect a more extreme Islamist position. None of the elements that led to the establishment of the Khomeini regime in Iran are present in Saudi Arabia. Unlike the Iranian scholars of 1978, the Wahhabis do not have a history of real opposition to the state, nor do they have a tradition of collective action or political sophistication in the management of crises or even the exploitation of political opportunities that appear in times of crisis. Unlike Iran, Saudi Arabia has produced no unifying charismatic opposition figure to Khomeini. And above all, the Iranian Islamic Republic represented an experiment. Iranians have not experienced strict Islamic rule in their lifetime. By contrast, Saudi subjects are simply sick of Wahhabism. But while Saudi Arabia need not go the way of Iran internally, the U.S. faces the serious threat of repetition of its error in Iran and Saudi Arabia. By remaining faithful to an alleged ally and questionable friend and propping up a corrupt regime even as it disintegrates. Such an outcome would be devastating for American credibility and would tragically reinforce the Islamist claim that our power exists only to support oppressive rulers. Although it is impossible to imagine a worse regime than that of Saudi Arabia in its relations with its subjects, U.S. intransigence in defending the most reactionary elements of the royal family could produce a less repressive but more anti-American successor government. I do not come to this discussion from an academic or government background. I have flattered myself in saying that I learned about Wahhabism the way George Orwell learned about Stalinism. George Orwell did not go to Moscow and did not speak a single word of Russian. Orwell, his first important work was his volume, Homage to Catalonia, which dealt with Soviet involvement in the Spanish Civil War. To understand global Stalinism, he went to Barcelona. I did not go to Saudi Arabia to study Wahhabism. I witnessed the attempts of Wahhabi Saudi agents to take over Balkan Islam. As a journalist covering the Balkan Wars, in Bosnia, Herzegovina, Kosovo, Macedonia, Montenegro, Serbia, and Albania, I first heard the word Wahhabi in a Yugoslav context more than 10 years ago. When I came back to the United States and the Balkans, Balkan Muslim intellectuals with whom I had become close asked me to expose Wahhabi Saudi religious colonialism to the Western public. This profound charge became even more serious after September 11th. Hostility to Wahhabi extremism is prevalent throughout the Muslim world, and I don't necessarily mean among the elites, because among the elites, Saudi money talks. Since we're here, presumably this is a private group, look at a situation like Musharraf. Musharraf in Pakistan is simply unwilling to do the necessary work that would consist of cracking down on the Wahhabi and neo-Wahhabi extremists who are murdering Muslims. The group that murdered Daniel Pearl was the first non-Muslim that they had killed. Musharraf is unwilling to take the necessary steps to suppress Islamist extremism in his country. This does not mean that Musharraf is a Wahhabi. This does not mean he's a Saudi agent, but Saudi money talks. In researching my book, I drew on informants, most of them confidential, that included Saudi subjects, West Africans, Moroccans, Algerians, Egyptians, Somalis, Chechens, Ingushes, Uzbeks, Pakistanis, Indian Muslims, Malaysians, Iraqis, as well as Balkan Muslims and American Muslims. What is the main goal of the Wahhabi-Saudi alliance? To destroy the traditional Islam present from Bosnia to South Africa, from Morocco to the Philippines, and replace it with their extremist, ultra-rigid, and puritanical version of Islam. And, of course, to maintain the monarchy in power in Saudi. Backed by Saudi Arabia, the Wahhabis have sought to extirpate Shia Islam and to abolish the traditional schools of Islamic jurisprudence. They despise to a point of homicidal rage traditional Islamic customs associated with Sufi spirituality. These include in particular the establishment and preservation of grave markers, tombs, and cemeteries, which are frequent targets of Wahhabi desecration. I have recently received complaints from Kurdish Muslims in northern Iraq, warning that the Wahhabi infiltrators, aligned with Al-Qaeda, have begun demolishing traditional tombs in that area. Destruction of tombs and cemeteries is often, in fact, the first sign of Wahhabi activity. Early in 1998, just before the eruption of armed conflict in Kosovo, I was informed by Albanian Muslim clerics that Wahhabis had commenced a campaign of vandalizing graveyards in the Albanian district of Macedonia. I personally observed the failure of Wahhabi Saudi infiltrators to take control of Islam in the Balkans. This cynical effort was motivated by the belief that the suffering undergone by the Balkan Muslims would induce these victims to turn away from their European roots and their open, tolerant Ottoman Islamic traditions and to embrace Wahhabi extremism. It failed. While the main immediate aim of Wahhabism is to capture and guide the global Islamic community, its doctrines are also deeply suffused with hatred of the other religions. This is something different from the aggravated, demagogic, and repulsive anti-Jewish propaganda disseminated by corrupt Arab regimes and Arab media in their campaign against Israel. It is also something different from any claim of ultimate and revelation and authority in traditional Islam. Wahhabism injects itself into the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, transforming what are essentially political issues into a highly charged ideological pseudo-religious challenge. Wahhabism uses politics and religion to advance its power-seeking agenda. Wahhabism is as different from ordinary anti-Israeli ideology or from even most of so-called militant Islam as Nazism was from the mentality of the German military in the First World War, as different as Stalinist communism was from the radical socialism of a generation before. It is Islamo-fascism. The extensions of the Wahhabi conspiracy, including such organizations as the Saudi government-backed Muslim World League, the World Assembly of Muslim Youth, headquartered in Saudi but with operations on American soil, are visible throughout the world. The failure of Western political and intellectual leaders to adequately understand the internal crisis in Islam and the conflict between tradition and extremism led not only to obliviousness in the face of the terror revealed on September 11th, but also to heedlessness in dealing with Islam on American soil, because Islam on American soil is essentially under Wahhabi control. I have said many times that Wahhabism has been successful in taking over Islam in only three countries: Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and the United States. At this point, certain measures have become imperative. One of them is for the U.S. to demand a full, transparent accounting of Saudi involvement in September 11th from the Saudi authorities. Today I was on Fox News and I was asked what I think of the Saudis' on-again, off-again offer to help us in the war against Iraq. I said, that's fine, but first we have to have a full accounting of Saudi involvement in September 11th, no matter how high it goes in the kingdom. The second is to demand that the Saudi government, like the Soviet government in the past and various right-wing dictatorships, cut off subsidies to the extremist ideology. Third and most important is to protect, support, and otherwise encourage American Muslims and other Muslims opposed to Wahhabism to develop their own community institutions and to produce a new articulate network of authoritative advocates. More importantly, as we see from the president's speech last night, I believe the moment has come to shift from the struggle to warn the West against jihadism to a campaign to support mainstream traditional Muslims throughout the world for the liberation of their communities from the grip of corrupt rulers, whether in Iraq, in Saudi Arabia, or elsewhere throughout the Arab and Muslim worlds. This is the mission of the Islam and Democracy Program I have created at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. Thank you for your time and attention.
Thank you, Steve, for your hard-hitting and powerful exposition. I think we know where he stands, right?
I'm used to holding back whenever I can.
One of the interesting things that happened after 9/11 from the perspective of the Middle East and Islam, especially, is how many new voices there are, people who are analyzing, taking up new subjects, and doing a very good job at it.
Thank you.
Stephen Schwartz is one of those who, you know, 5 years ago was doing other things, but now is doing this and doing it very well. for which I, as a Middle East specialist, am very grateful.
And I'm grateful.
A lot of work to be done, and more hands are now doing it. I'm delighted to be here. As you know, missed a lot of these briefings. Gary Gamble has been doing it in my stead, and I'm grateful to him. And I'm afraid I'll miss more in the future. Gary will be there again, but at least this time I'm here. Gary, by the way, was on Hardball a couple of days ago, where he came out with the observation that, on the same subject, that I think you said that 95% of what the what Al-Qaeda believes in, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia teaches. It's a lot of overlap. But that's actually the point that I want to bring up. Because in my understanding of the Saudi history, there was a fundamental diversion that took place in 1924 and the years that followed. In other words, pre-1924, there was a very, very extreme interpretation of Islam, as you characterized it. And then in 1924, with the capture of Mecca, the king, Abdulaziz ibn Saud, had a choice to make, and he chose to modernize it somewhat. And as a result, he had a lot of dissension within his own within his own ranks. And a group who became known as the Ikhwan, the brothers, the brethren, revolted in the late 1920s, and he suppressed them. And since then, there have been manifestations of this Ikhwan, more extremist version of Wahhabism. Most notably, the 1979 takeover of the Meccan mosque, and most notably of all, the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. It's the less extreme and the more extreme. And symbolically, one could say that whereas in Saudi Arabia, women can't drive, in the Taliban version, women basically couldn't go out. Women can go to school in Saudi Arabia, segregated schools, but in Afghanistan, they didn't. I mean, there are real substantial differences, and however extreme the Saudi version is, the Taliban version is several steps further. You seem to be saying it's all one. I mean, that's the 5%, as it were, with Gary now. I might say it's more than 5%, but you're saying, secretly saying it's all one. It's just one group. Don't you recognize at all that there are conflicting strains?
Well, there are conflicting strains in exactly the same way that there were conflicting strains in communism. In the same way that you had essentially Muscovite communism, which had arrived at a position of calling for peaceful coexistence with the West, at the same time as they fostered mercenaries that took over various countries in Africa. They fostered extremist movements in Latin America. They secretly supported terrorism in Western Europe. Then you, of course, had Maoism, which was still part of the communist movement, but had its own dispensation, its own interpretation. I certainly do recognize the distinctions. I would say that there has always been in Wahhabism a tension between the tendency to accommodate to the West in order to maintain power in the peninsula and the essence of the ideology. Now the question is, will we continue to try to exploit this tension for our benefit, or will we once and for all tell them that they have to stop spreading the ideology? We in the West have had essentially had the tendency to say that as long as they did things like suppressing the Ikhwan, and they didn't really suppress the Ikhwan completely, they suppressed the Ikhwan, but then they set up the Mutawiyahs, and they took a lot of the cadres of the Ikhwan and put them to work in the religious militia. So it was a situation, I said in my book that all extremist regimes do this at some point or another. I mean, the Nazi regime had, you know, the Night of the Long Knives, where they killed all the extremist leaders from the brown shirts. The Soviet regime had its series of purges and so forth, so on and so forth. China had the Cultural Revolution. I mean, all extremist regimes do this at some point or another. They have to liquidate those who don't understand or don't accept the accommodations that are made. The other thing I said in my book is that I thought that if Ibn Abdul Wahhab and Ibn Saud had appeared in a dream to Osama bin Laden, they would have said to him, cool it, we've always fooled the unbelievers and we'll continue to do so. So there are differences that are differences of strategy, differences of accommodation, differences of interest. There is always this two-sided, two faces of Wahhabism in the sense of one face which accommodates to the West for political benefit in the peninsula while continuing to press the ideology. And I think that there are other differences, but in essence, the core of the ideology is the same, just as the core of communist ideology was the same.
Unlike Mr. Schwartz, I actually have been to Saudi Arabia. In fact, I've lived there for 10 years. And I travel there about 3 times a year. I agree with Mr. Pipes completely. This is an extremely powerful and possibly persuasive presentation, but I think it is truly, one of the grossest distortions I've ever heard. I don't want to really get into that, but I would ask a question because I'm truly puzzled by this. My impression, without being an expert on Islamic religious fundamentalism, that Al-Qaeda's roots, ideological roots, are very clearly in the Muslim Brotherhood of Egypt and the ideology that has sprung out of that, and that Osama bin Laden's lieutenant, as you know, is in fact Egyptian. And one of the chief ideologues of that movement has absolutely nothing to do with Saudi Wahhabism. The pull of Al Qaeda on the young minds of Muslims around the world is not a Wahhabi pull. In fact, Saudis don't even recognize the term Wahhabi. You know, it's like Protestants. I happen to be Protestant. It's like a Protestant saying, well, a Calvinist, you know, stream of Protestantism. It's like a non-issue for modern Protestants. It's true that Saudis practice an austere version of Islam. That's true. You can call it puritanical or whatever you want. But it's not true to say that Saudis think of themselves necessarily as Wahhabi. And so it may very well be that somebody is spreading something that they call Wahhabism. But I don't think it's the Saudi populace, as you've referred to many times, without actually meeting the Saudi populace. The Saudi populace does not have this concept in their head. So, two questions. One, the ideological roots of Al-Qaeda and Taliban and others versus the Wahhabi roots, which you seem to think they have. And secondly, I'd like to be very clear on whether you believe the Saudi government and the royal family per se is spreading what you call Wahhabism around the world, or whether it is, as some claim, private individuals within Saudi Arabia.
Okay, answering the second question first. The Muslim World League, the World Assembly of Muslim Youth, and these various other organizations are official arms of the Saudi government. There's simply no doubt about this. You can go to the office of the World Assembly of Muslim Youth in North Virginia, and you can buy a little pamphlet on Shia Islam that says that Shia Islam is not Islam, that it's part of a Jewish conspiracy. That answers that question as far as I'm concerned.
I address the fact that they don't call themselves
Islam. Hold on, I've got all the rest. They don't call themselves Wahhabis, they call themselves Salafis. And as I recall, the communists don't like to be called communists or Stalinists, they like to be called progressives and liberals. Exactly the same deal. The term Wahhabi has become...
Wahhabi is a neutral...
Wahhabi is not a neutral term. Wahhabi is not a neutral term. Muslims all over the world view the term Wahhabi exactly the same way people all over the world view the term Stalinist. And for that reason, they call themselves Salafi.
Maybe Mr. Price can clarify this, but there is a concept in Saudi Islam, if you want to call it, or Islam's kind of Saudi Islam.
Muad'Dun. That's what they call themselves.
Well, I can talk about the Muad'Dun for hours and hours.
Which we translate in the West as Unitarian.
Well, yeah, that's like when communists call themselves Unitarians. I mean, that's like when Stalinists call themselves Methodists.
I'll get to the Muad'Dun.
Muad'Dun means a believer in the oneness of God.
Right. Exactly.
And the unicity of God, the uniqueness of God. It also means forbidding the public praise of the prophet, because the argument is that if you publicly praise the prophet, you're setting the prophet up next to God as an idol. It also means the destruction of tombs, because if you visit tombs, graveyards, you're setting up tombs and graveyards as idols alongside God.
Do you know what the Shahada is?
Of course I know what the Shahada is.
Is that praise the prophet?
What?
Is that praise the prophet?
The Shahada praises the prophet. If the Saudis had it their way, they would remove the prophet from the Shahada. Exactly the way they destroyed... Hold on. Exactly the way they destroyed the house in which Muhammad was born. Exactly the way they destroyed the graveyard in which the companions were all buried. Exactly the way they destroyed the house in which the parents of the prophet were born. The record of Wahhabism, and this is not something that I invented, this is something you can find in hundreds of Islamic works, is a record of destroying everything in traditional Islam that they claim smacks of setting anything up alongside God alone as worthy of worship. And I'm going to finish my point to you.
Have you ever seen artwork, for example?
Look, are you going to let me answer the question, or are you going to engage in a debate with me? Because if you want to engage in a debate with me, we can hire a hall. I didn't come here to have one person come out of the audience and force me into a debate. I'm going to answer your question.
Mr. Schwartz, the entire group, I apologize.
Let me just finish answering the questions. Every scrap of Al-Qaeda literature, the phony fatwas of Osama bin Laden, who does not have the religious training to write a fatwa, the fatwas that are at least fatwas of Zawahiri, who does have religious training, every single one of them refers to Salafism as the ideology of this movement. In fact, the main groups, such as the group in Algeria, are called the Salafist Group of Combat and Dawah and Islamic Call. Salafism is to Wahhabism as the word progressive is to the word communist, or as the word socialist is to the word Stalinist. It is a cover word. I'm not going to get into the whole explanation of why the term Salafi doesn't apply to the Wahhabis any more than the term progressive or socialist applies to Stalinists. I can get into that, but I don't choose to. Your point about the Egyptian Islamic Brotherhood, this is a very interesting discussion that I've had with Dr. Pikes, and I've had discussions with like this with other people. The argument is made that the extremist movement in drawing on the Islamic Brotherhood in Egypt and drawing in the followers of Maududi in Pakistan, that these are not classic Wahhabi organizations. They were not classic Wahhabi organizations. There are things about them that were very different. For one thing, Wahhabism per se never emphasized the struggle against the Western imperialists, as the Islamic Brotherhood in Egypt did, and as the followers of Maududi did. And the followers of Maududi in Pakistan also had a history of some accommodation with Sufism, which is strictly forbidden in Saudi Wahhabi Islam. However, they have something very important in common. All three of them declare that the existing traditional Islam is a state of jahiliyyah, or ignorance, such as existed before the Quran was delivered to Muhammad. Thus, they declare that all Muslims, traditional Muslims, and Muslims who follow existing Islam are unbelievers. This is Wahhabi takfir, a Wahhabi practice of declaring that those who are not followers of the dispensation are not Muslims at all, but are unbelievers. This was the ideological basis that Wahhabism in Saudi Arabia, the Egyptian Islamic Brotherhood, and the followers of Maulana Maududi in Pakistan had in common. In 1962, when the Muslim World League was set up, it was set up on the basis of providing the money to bring members of the Egyptian Islamic Brotherhood and followers of Maulana Maududi from Pakistan to come to Saudi Arabia to function in the Muslim World League, and that was where you had a situation where two groups that I would call quasi-Wahhabi or neo-Wahhabi became Wahhabized. Certainly, it's very important to understand, Saudi Arabia exercises a gravitational pull on other Sunni extremist groups exactly like the Soviet Union exercised on groups like Cuba or the Sandinistas in Nicaragua. In my past leftist life, I was literally present at the earliest meetings of the formation of the Sandinista Frente. The Sandinista Frente did not start out by telling people they were all going to go learn Russian. They started out saying that they represented something independent that was fighting a separate struggle. The same is true of Castro's movement. But the gravitational pull of the Soviet Union was so great that it drew these groups into its orbit and essentially Sovietized them. Wahhabism, Saudi Wahhabism, does exactly the same thing with groups like the Islamic Brotherhood, in the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, and the followers of Maududi in Pakistan. And by the way, I don't believe that the population in Saudi is Wahhabi. I believe the populace in Saudi is only at most about 10% Wahhabi. Maybe if forced to give an identification with some member of the militia around, might maybe you get a count of 40%. I think the majority of people living in Saudi, the subjects of Saudi, are not Wahhabi. They are Shia. They are followers of the pluralistic schools of jurisprudence. And they are members of the two generations who simply want an end to this, the ideological grip that this form of Islam has on the country.
Before we go on, you mentioned the Egyptian and Pakistani variants of militant Islam. What about the Iranian one, which clearly is very distinct, and yet, you know, if we were discussing this topic 20 years ago, we would only be talking about Iran.
I know. There's a lot to be said about this. First of all, there was always a line of blood between the Wahhabis and the Shias. So even when, because the Wahhabis have always killed Shias, Wahhabis are now killing Shias. Saudi-funded groups in Pakistan, the Sipahi Sabah and the Lashkar Jhangvi, the groups that murdered Daniel Pearl, murdered 9 Pakistani Shias last week. There was always a line of blood between Shiism and Wahhabism. In the late 1970s, because of the common sense of a struggle against Israel and against the United States, there was what looked like a convergence. I don't believe that the convergence actually took place. I believe that the distance was too great. And I think that what is unarguable is that today Iran is progressing, slowly but noticeably progressing, toward a normal state, while Saudi is attempting to maintain itself as a reactionary monarchy. I'm trying to think that there was something else about that I wanted to mention, but I do think, I wouldn't make two comments about this, by the way. Part of what got the Wahhabis going in the late 70s, we can all say a lot of things against Khomeini, but Khomeini was not a hypocrite. When Khomeini said they were going to set up an Islamic Republic, there were not any exemptions. There wasn't a situation, a sense that you could... You could say you were against alcohol and pornography in public, but you could do whatever you wanted behind your compound walls as long as you were a prince. Furthermore, when Khomeini said he was against the West, he followed through on it and threw the Westerners out. This was an enormous challenge to the longstanding hypocrisy of the Saudis. And if there's another point, I'll go back.
I'm David Bronstein. Listening to your indictment of Saudi Wahhabism, and certainly being the Middle East forum's focus on militant Islam, it would appear that a primary target of U.S. foreign policy and pressure should be Saudi Arabia as opposed to Iraq. That seems to be pretty powerful. First question, do you think that the current march towards confrontation with Iraq is the right priority and the right objective? And the second question is, if we accept President Bush's views as he expressed them last night, that there is a more stable civil society, and perhaps even a democracy in Iraq. What impact could that have, in your judgment, on both the Wahhabi clerical, the clergy and the religious functions, and of the Saudi government?
Yes. Well, first, I'm entirely in favor of the liberation of Iraq. I completely support the administration on this. And to back up a little bit, I don't think that a military campaign against Saudi Arabia is necessary. This is what I think is going to happen. I think Iraq will be liberated. The liberation of Iraq, which does not mean that Iraq becomes Connecticut in 24 hours, it does mean that Shia Muslims who have been persecuted by the Saddam regime have freedom. It does mean the opening up of tremendous entrepreneurial energies that have been blocked. It does mean the beginning of the emergence of a civil society and of the beginning of a democracy. First of all, let's not miss the middle step. Because of the fact that Iraq is a majority Shia country, a liberated Iraq can have a very powerful impact in propelling and as an incentive to the consolidation of democratic change in Iran. And that doesn't mean Iran is going to become a Connecticut in 24 hours either. The point is, liberation of Iraq, advance of the democratization in Iran, then we have the question of incentives to political change in Saudi. Now, it is my argument that the Saudi elite is tremendously fearful of this. For one reason, because liberated Iraq and consolidation of democratic gains in Iran means an incentive for Shias to come out from hiding and to stop putting up with the extraordinary and extreme persecution and discrimination they suffer in Saudi Arabia. Second, I mean, democratizing countries on the northern border, the northern frontier, the northern proximity to Saudi Arabia, the Saudi populace are not people living in tents. They will know what's going on. It will be an incentive to a democratic, I wouldn't call it a democratizing movement. I would call it a transitional movement in Saudi Arabia. I don't call for any war. I don't call for any seizure of oil fields. I said I'm in favor of a transition to an Islamic and constitutional, parliamentary and Islamic and constitutional Islamic monarchy in Saudi that would look like Malaysia, in which the Al Saud may keep their wealth. But I think that the success of the liberation of Iraq is a tremendous incentive to democratization in Iran and is the beginning of a transition and a transformation in Saudi. The religious issues are extremely interesting. The Ba'athist regime in Iraq has attempted to put a little, Wahhabi oil on itself. The Saudis, my interpretation is that the Saudis are always mainly frightened of Iran because Iran and Khomeini represented such a striking example of non-hypocrisy. And also they have a cultural inferiority complex about Iran. And also because Iran is a Shia country and they hate Shias. I think that they basically had a policy of accommodating and even supporting and sustaining Saddam. The main thing is that a liberated Shia Iraq will provide a new pole, a theological pole within the world of the Shia Muslims. And, you know, the rise of pluralistic Islam in Iraq, bottom line, is a tremendous incentive to the renewal of pluralistic Islam in Saudi Arabia.
Look, at, from the American point of view, how would you respond to Mike's accusation that Saudi Arabia is not an enemy, it's not a friend, it's a rival?
Good enough for me. It works for
rival.
Me.
Rival. Yeah, like China's a rival.
Yeah.
You can work with it, you can get benefits, you got to worry about it, all these things. It's complex.
I will say I've seen Iran more as being like China. In the China, in the end, Mao was more concerned with his internal social experiment than he was with international troublemaking. And I think that the Iranians can be induced to pull their horns in because of their concern about their internal situation. But I would see the Saudi more as the Soviet Union. But it's the same thing. Yeah, I don't disagree with that.
Would you like to discuss here for us what you think the relationship is between the leadership of Saudi Arabia and Iraq and Al-Qaeda, in terms of theology, in terms of the
alliance? Well, okay, the theology of the Saudi state is Wahhabism, Salafism, whatever you want to call it. The ideology of Al-Qaeda is Salafism. The overwhelming majority of the cadres of Al-Qaeda are Saudis, or people from other Gulf states under Saudi influence. I mean, that says it all as far as I'm concerned. I am not making accusations about members of the royal family. I debated Prince Turki al-Faisal on CNN. I did not, to the displeasure of some of my friends, I did not accuse him of being the front man for Osama bin Laden. I don't make accusations about members of the royal family. But the fact is, the royal family supports Wahhabism, Salafism, and Al-Qaeda, which is essentially a Saudi movement. It's a movement that reflects that ideology. I think I said before, the situation with Iraq is very interesting because the Saudis view Iraq as their buffer against Iran. And the Ba'athist regime, which for some strange reason in the West is constantly portrayed as this ultra-secularist regime, as if it were something similar to... I don't know what, Turkey. The fact is that the Ba'athist regime has always had a mix, and I mean, Dr. Pipes knows these topics better than me, correct me if I'm wrong, but it always had a strange mix of secularist, Arab nationalism. It had two founders, one of which was, I believe, Orthodox, a flock, Orthodox Christian. It always had a strange mixture of a sort of secularism, Arab nationalism, but then in power, as I said, it spread a little Wahhabi oil on itself and tried to make itself, yeah, I mean, they put part of the Shahada on the flag of the country. Allahu Akbar is on the flag of the country. The thing is that Iraq, they view Iraq as a buffer against Iran. The Ba'athist regime in Iraq has given itself this Islamist cover. And I think that this is why they are reluctant to support our endeavor. One of the reasons, above all the fear of change, is one of the reasons that, are among the reasons that motivate their reluctance to assist in the liberation of Iraq.
I would slightly disagree with your portrayal of the Ba'athist. I think what you see in both Iraq and Syria is an accommodation to realities. When Saddam Hussein added the Allahu Akbar to the flag was 1990, when his support throughout the world was coming in large part from the Islamists, from the followers of militant Islam. So as a present to them, he said, "Well, I'm with you." And the same thing you find in Syria, where in his last years, Hafez al-Assad, who had in earlier times killed 20,000 of them in one city, reached an accommodation because they were strong. But the ideology itself, insofar as Ba'athism is a serious ideology, is pretty secular. But, you know, they've had to come to terms with the realities around them.
Context, and Dr. Pipes can correct me if he thinks I'm wrong. I think on the one hand, let's face it, it's a much smaller country, much easier deal. For him to basically say we're going to turn a page in our history is a great deal easier than it's going to be in Saudi Arabia. Secondly, I've been a little bit cynical and called that country the Yugoslavia of Wahhabism, in the sense of a controlled experiment in a more moderate and open form of the whole thing. The third thing I would say is, let's not make the assumption that 9/11 was some great victory for Islamism. 9/11 was a disaster, a devastating setback for these people. Millions of Muslims got up the next day and said, I never signed on for this. And I think that there are rulers, and I think there are people even in the Saudi royal family, for example, Crown Prince Abdullah, who I can discuss at great length, who I think realize that the Saudi regime has got to be extricated from this. I didn't mention him when I said that someone in the royal family can do what Juan Carlos did, because it's very complicated and it's very controversial, this issue of the status of Abdullah, who also, by the way, is 80 years old. But I'm not denying that there are people in the ruling strata who understand that this is a disastrous situation to be in. The thing is, though, in the history of these kinds of regimes, there are always people in the ruling strata who understand that they're in a difficult situation and who want to somehow get out of it. The question is, can they prevail? Generally, they don't. On the other hand, I have said Saudi Arabia today is at a fork in the road. On one side of the road are signs that say South Korea, the Philippines, Spain, Mexico, countries that have Hungary, Poland, countries that have successfully left authoritarian or totalitarian rule without violence, without substantial violence, and are now stable and prosperous countries. And at the other side of the fork of the road are portraits of the last king of France and the last czar of Russia and the last shah of Iran and Somoza and Marcos. And the choice is theirs. God willing, they make the right choice. God willing, Abdullah can assert, if as some many people believe, can assert his power in a way that would separate the regime from Wahhabism and from the past and would turn a new page in the history of the regime. That's what I meant when I said a Juan Carlos Windsor Malaysia solution. But who knows?
One additional comment on the Qatari. Prince Abdullah is 80. The ruler in Qatar, Hamid, had a soft coup. He threw his father out some decade ago. And he has been an experimenter. He started Al Jazeera, for example. He's been very ambitious in his foreign policy, and I think his action that you pointed to, changing the educational system, is in keeping with a different kind of more dynamic leadership than one finds in geriatric Saudi leadership circles.
Can I make one brief interpolation? I went on CNN yesterday and I made some comments about what's going to happen in Iraq, and then I went back to my office and we had a big argument. And look, I spent a long time in the radical left, and I spent a long time as an opponent of wars, and I am not a warmonger, and I am not bloodthirsty, and I do not want to see a single drop of blood to flow in Saudi Arabia. I want, and I fervently hope, that elements of the royal family can take over the situation and can guide the country out of this mess, can extricate the country from Wahhabism and put it on the road to a Malaysian solution. I'm not calling for a Turkish solution. I'm not calling for secularism. I'm not calling for throwing the gates of the kingdom open to Protestant missionaries. I'm calling for a Malaysian solution, a constitutional and parliamentary Islamic monarchy. I want a transition. But a transition cannot take place if we continue to mislead ourselves and if we hold to this principle, the Kissingerian principle, that they are our friends and we stick by them to the end. We have to face these realities. It's only, as I said to Prince Turki, I'm in favor of restoring the relationship. In many respects, economically above all, it was a positive relationship for both sides. But it can only be restored on the basis of candor. They have to be candid about 9/11. They have to tell us what really happened, how they were involved in it, and who was involved in it. And we have to be candid in saying that we will no longer take the position that the mysterious Desert Kingdom is a place where, when Barbara Walters goes, the only question she asks is, gee, what kind of camel is that? And where did that dagger come from? No, no, no. There's got to be an end to that. There's got to be an end to what's the other one? The other one on the Today Show, Katie Couric going and saying, "Gee, the Arabian horses sure do go fast." That's got to stop. There has got to be candor on both sides. When there is candor on both sides, and I fervently hope and wish that there will be candor on both sides, then we can reestablish the relationship, and it can be a healthy relationship and a positive relationship.
I'm afraid our time is up. It is 1:30, but maybe we'll go another couple minutes.
Another couple minutes.
So, quick question here and here.
Okay, Steve, thank you for being here first.
Thank you.
More of a political question than a religious one. Could you talk a little bit about the geopolitical situation as it relates to Turkey, the uniqueness of Turkey, at least it's out of Turkey?
Yeah, this is maybe more controversial.
One more. Dealing also with the issue of the northern border of Iraq and the southern border of Turkey and the whole issue of the Kurds.
I'll talk a little bit about Turkey. The rest I leave up to this man. I'm the Turkey-Balkan guy. I say this always. He's the Arab guy.
Afterwards. All right, afterwards.
I think that the regime of Mustafa Kemal went too far. I think that most Turkish Muslims want to live in a country where you're neither forced, women are neither forced to wear head covering nor prohibited from wearing head covering. I think they want to live in a regime where nobody is forced to follow Islamic guidance, but people are not prohibited from following Islamic guidance. And for that reason, I think it wasn't a situation where people were prohibited from following Islamic guidance, but it is a very aggressive secularist regime. I do think that it should not be a situation where when a Sufi sheikh walks into the the Hagia Sophia Mosque and delivers a call to prayer, he's arrested and beaten up. I think they are stepping back from the radical secularist position that they took for so long. It seems to me that this is not a negative thing. This is something we've disagreed on, Dan and I, in the past. Above all, Turkey, even though the French don't think Turkey's part of Europe, Turkey is geographically part of Europe, Turkish Islam has always been more oriented towards European civilization, and I think Turkey is a positive element in the picture.
Since 9/11, we've all seen the press reports on the millions of dollars that the Saudis have spent on trying to revamp their tarnished image in this country. Briefly, how successful have they been, and can you give us a glimpse into what their strategy is?
He's a PR man himself.
Well, we had a two-pronged approach. One was to put on rather silly-looking advertised three-pronged approach. One is TV spots that show pictures of Ibn Saud and the successors of Ibn Saud as various American presidents. I don't think this cuts much ice with people. I'm sorry to say 15 out of 19 is simply an undeniable fact that can't be wished away. The second phenomenon is we have Donald Joubert and others who get up and say, we're cracking down, we're making arrests, we're tracing the money. Somehow we never find out the names of these people. Somehow we never find out anything about this. And furthermore, people that we know, I mean, there's a guy named Yasin al-Qadi. I know more about Yasin al-Qadi than anybody in the United States who doesn't work in the Justice Department. Yasin al-Qadi is still walking around in Riyadh, a completely free man. So, I mean, you know, Donald Joubert gets up and makes these statements about how much they're doing. I'm sorry, I don't believe it. And above all, nothing they do is going to be as important as coming clean about 9/11. They've got to do this. And by the way, this is also the beginning of health for their society. This means that candor toward us is candor within their society. And, I mean, I'm sure there's plenty of lawyers here. Lawyers, like journalists, believe, I presume, that, you know, sunlight is the best disinfectant, right? Third thing is they do have a group of people in the United States, the ex-ambassadors, who have come back as honorary ambassadors from Saudi. And one of them accused Dr. Price of being a liar to his face, and then practically gave me the impression that he was going to try to beat me up. And these guys are working overtime on this. Look, 15 out of 19 cannot be wished away. 15 out of 19 would still be there even if I were writing a book about crypto-Catholicism in northern Albania or something. 15 out of 19 cannot be wished away. No, nothing short of candor about 9/11 is going to change the situation.
Isn't the more relevant statistic the percentage at Guantanamo Bay? Because Bin Laden did choose who to send on the...
It's relevant because everybody knows about 15 about 10 out of 19. I don't buy it by the argument, you know, the argument that Bin Laden chose Saudis to do these things, I don't buy this at all. That's like saying that the Soviets chose Russians to go to Cuba or Nicaragua. Al-Qaeda is a Saudi movement. Hey, listen, I'll tell you something that would really cause trouble. If they had found some Bosnians or Albanians to go on those flights, that would really upset the West. That would really cause some problems. I don't think there was any choice that had to do with disrupting U.S.-Saudi relationships. There was a choice of those who were fanatics and prepared to carry the act. Do you want to leave one more question? And I've got to get one. Oh, no, okay, that's it. Okay. You're the shame. Thank you very much.
Most appreciated. Thank you all for joining us. Please put your name tag on the table on the way out. We hope to see you soon again.
Yeah.
I'm going to go to the next one.